Is fentanyl considered an opioid, or is it considered a different category?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best way in the past people made a distinction between opiates and opioids. And I think today everybody is just using the phrase opioids as all of the drugs that hail from the painkiller and originate or emulate the poppy plant. And so fentanyl is considered an opioid, and people are even throwing heroin into the opioid category.
I came tonight hoping to hear some positive steps, some
Yes.
information about what might be done and how things might change. All this sounds very familiar to me. I've been hearing this kind of stuff for a long time and seeing it too. So, any
Yes.
projects, any changes in laws or actual programs that are helping people?
Do you want to tell them about the new the piece on MATs that you just wrote?
Yeah, so there's lots of good news, and that is, thank you for
Yes.
asking. That's a really, no, it's a really, really good
I
reminder,
was
because I
wondering when we were
think
going to get to that.
it is very easy to get caught up in the difficult things. There's a lot of great work being done. Recently, the state formed the Behavioral Health Consortium, and I will tell you, as someone who is a third-party observer, there are new voices at the table, and there are unique voices at the table, and so work is actually being done. We're seeing the Behavioral Health Consortium has mapped out a 3-year plan, with year one, year two, year three. The great part about that is that they are actually looking at not just addiction, but mental health. So they're looking at the root causes
Yes.
of a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
So it's some of the work we've been doing, we've chronicled along. Dr. Sandy Gibney from St. Francis is doing some of that work, going out and legitimately just distributing naloxone on the streets. Getting this harm reduction aspect going. They're talking about in coming weeks and months, coupling that with mental health outreach workers, with community health workers, to kind of make sure that they're having an all-encompassing vehicle when they're out there. The state also recently launched Delaware START, which is going to look to create this continuum of care. So that way, no matter where you are, if you fall off, if you relapse, or if you decide you need to get help, you're ready to get help, you can enter the system from a multiple different pathways. And so I said, a lot of people describe recovery as a journey, and I said it's really unique the state has taken on this idea of a pathway. They want people to find it. Recently, there was legislation passed to create an overdose system of care. So that way, when someone overdoses, there will be a consistent response statewide, no matter where it happens to you. So it won't be that you got a really great doctor who understands addiction and knows how to respond. Instead, there's going to be consistent things put in place. We're seeing a couple hospitals open up stabilization centers there. So we're not looking to send someone to a Kirkwood detox. We're not looking to send someone else. We can actually keep people and make sure they're getting the help they need. There is a bunch of legislation stuff that's been passed and talked about. There's efforts to make sure that we have parity for people who are having issues with mental health and with addiction. And there's also been a lot larger effort to get insurance providers to support and approve things like massage therapy, like yoga, like physical therapy. So alternatives to opioids. Because Tammy made a great point, and I hear it from readers all the time. There are a lot of people that legitimately need their opioid pain medication, and they want it, and they're in pain. And it's a story that we've been working on for quite some time, and it's a difficult one to tell, but it's important. So no, there's lots and lots of positive work. And I will tell you, there are so many, and it cannot be discounted, so many incredible people in recovery that are out there doing that work right now. Who? Oh, well, that's a good question.
Yeah.
But no,
Great
there
support
is.
groups. Attack Addiction is very active at when they first began. It's a support group for people suffering opioid use disorders as well as their families. And it started in Newcastle County, but now it's very active across the state. They even have members from Attack Addiction here who have been able to get laws passed in Delaware, like the Good Samaritan law. That is, if you take somebody, drop somebody off at the hospital who's ODing, you can be free from prosecution. I hope I summarized that okay, David. He probably can help me out. Expanded access to Medicaid-assisted treatment, methadone, buprenorphine, and now Vivitrol. But we have to also, Vivitrol, methadone, and buprenorphine will help deal with cravings and withdrawal. But we also have to couple that
with the social triggers, addressing the social triggers that could lead people back. It's one thing to handle the biological, neurological part, but, you know, if somebody's out of work, if they're depressed, if they're suffering from mental health, if they're around people who are using, those are social triggers, and the state is also working on a continuum of care. So it's all very, very encouraging. And we're doing stuff on the technology end. We're developing an app, for example, that will help people find the resources they need when they need them and near them. We're not quite ready to talk about that now, but there are other things like that which are happening. That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it.
Since you brought it up, a quick comment on the 911 Good Samaritan law. It's been a law here in Delaware for 5 years. People should know about it. What it does is allow anybody to call 911 if they find somebody in medical distress. The idea is that they stay with that person in medical distress until the professionals arrive to revive that person. The other thing that even the people who are aware of the 911 Good Samaritan law, it often gets lost, it also applies to underage drinking, which is hugely important, and there's not enough people that understand that.
It's, if I can add to, and not to put Dave and his wife on the spot back there, but I'm going to, it is really worth pointing out, not just locally but nationwide, that it is parents of who have lost children who are driving this effort. It is only recently that we are seeing, and recently as in the past few years, that we are seeing states and local officials really take on this charge. But that charge has been championed by parents who and loved ones who have taken their grief and put it towards something really, really meaningful. And so I always find it very important to remind that because it really, really is. And it is because of you guys that we are where we are today.
Hi, and quickly for the lady who had the question about positive measures being taken in Delaware, the Brandywine Counseling Center is now offering a syringe exchange within Wilmington, which is a great program. Syringe exchanges all around the country and in Canada have been shown to reduce HIV rates. They've been shown to get people into treatment faster because people handing out syringes usually give them the tools that they need to enter treatment and give them, you know, lots of information about how to make it affordable for them. Another really great thing is the Delaware Drug Court. Speaking of legislation, the drug courts help reduce penalties for people within their first and second offenses, as long as it's not trafficking or something huge. If it's minor, just like doing a drug, it, you know, prevents them from being incarcerated or having it on their record permanently. So those are two really good measures too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. That's great.
Hi, so building off of, the last two things that have been brought up, I don't know if in the research you've seen, in Vancouver they actually opened a safe injection site. So I'm curious as to if we see something like that potentially happening. I know Philadelphia right now is currently advocating for one, but do you think having these kinds of facilities would create more positive outcomes for those that are going through things with opioids? Do you see that being something we could possibly do here?
So I will give, we wrote a story on this a little bit earlier this year. The answer from the state right now is that it is being talked about in very, very early stages. With that said, there is a lot of research into it. You will talk to people who are very, very strong advocates. From the harm reduction standpoint, it is a harm reduction measure. What I will tell you, however, though, is it is something that I consistently hear, though, from law enforcement and from legal people that say it is going to take a very, very long time, probably, for us to figure out how to implement it. I was speaking with a law enforcement officer up in Philly who said, for example, you know, if we were to pull someone over and they had a bunch of heroin in their car and they say, well, I'm going to the safe injection site to use, do they still get penalized? What does that look like if there's drug dealers outside of a safe injection site? And so it's definitely something that I think the state is going to talk about. And it's on the radar of state officials. It's on the radar of the Behavioral Health Consortium. But it's definitely something that locally here is in its very early stages and has been indicated to me that it will likely be seen how other places like Philadelphia handle it, because Philly's been talking about it for, I think we're almost to a year now, and it's a slow process, unfortunately. but it is a harm reduction measure, and there's a lot of research out there. And so I think it depends, too, on the pathway you're looking at.
The increased availability of Narcan, the life-saving drug, is a big step in the right direction. So keeping what this map doesn't show you and what the news reports aren't, they don't cover, are the saves. The people who actually overdose and then get saved by their family members or get saved by other addicts, you know, that they're using drugs with because they have a couple doses of Narcan in their pocket. And those save the overdoses that aren't fatal. They're increasing as well. And I to tell you how dangerous this addiction is, the best advertisement a drug dealer could possibly have for his or her product is a bunch of people overdose on it. That is contrary to what you would think, but when people overdose on a drug, other addicts flock, others flock to find that and purchase that product. Why do they do it? Because it must be very good. I've been hearing that story since the 1990s. People don't stay away from drug dealers who sell doses that people overdose from. They flock to them. That shows you what we're up against.
Question over here. It's you. Hi. I'm interested in the NAS babies born addicted. And because we have so many of them now, I wondered in your database, are you able to capture that number of the babies born addicted? And would they be counted as addicts? Would they be counted? How about that population?
So we don't keep track of them in DOMIP. DOMIP doesn't have them. But the CDC keeps track, I believe, of babies born addicted. So the federal government has agencies. I don't know if our Department of Public Health does or not. I don't know if they do. My guess is that they probably do. And my colleague probably could answer that question better than I could. I know there's federal data on it, and there would be a rate for Delaware. We don't have it as part of our product, our project. They would be counted as addicted, but they're immediately weaned off before, my understanding, before they leave the hospital.
Yeah, we do have. There's been a council that's been formed to kind of manage this and deal with it. And I do find it's important to say, because I hear this a lot from healthcare providers and things. Technically, babies are not born addicted. They are just born substance dependent. And so it's a really good thing, because I just want to make sure I differentiate, because in this larger conversation of addiction, if addiction is a brain disease, a child is not born with that. They may be born substance dependent.
Detoxed.
Yeah, and there is question about what that could mean down the road, and those are all really, really good questions. But the state is tracking it. Like I said, I believe recently, actually, it was a council that was formed to, in particular, study that data and look at it. Right. And I have to say this because I think what Tammy gets to do is so cool. But, like, please know that a lot of this data, because it's health data, is protected. And so it's data that myself, as a journalist, does not always have access to. So I think it's the coolest that you're doing this overdose map, because I've wanted this data
forever. Put
that
link in the News Journal tomorrow.
I would love to do that. We might be doing that tomorrow morning. but it is, I do think it's really important.
Shameful production.
I think it's really important to remind people
promotion.
That, too, though, when talking about this, because so much of the stories that we do and that I get to tell really are because people have the courage and bravery to come forward and share their story. Because I will tell you, health data really is protected in this state. And really, people, unless something happens very publicly, are pretty protected from me finding out exactly who they are and things like that.
So. Let me chime in on the NAS thing. Another thing to consider about neonatal abstinence syndrome or people born, babies born addicted. I think we need to learn lessons from some of the mistakes we made about crack babies. Science made a lot of mistakes. The medical community made a lot of mistakes, And there was a lot of bad consequences that came from that. Women got who gave birth to a crack-addicted baby got sent to prison. Thank good, we deemed crack-addicted babies as a dysfunctional generation, and we later found out that within 2 years they had normal development, and in the meantime they bore the stigma of that era. I hope we don't. There's some lessons that we need to pay attention to the past. I know history is boring for a lot of people, but it's very important in not in problem solving, right?
A question from Ms. Horn. You've done a remarkable job covering the story. It sounds like you've been to every corner of the state, is that right? And talked to people whose families have gone through this and had those difficult conversations. And the passion you have about it comes through. So my question is, how does it feel when the President of the United States calls you and your colleagues enemies of the people?
My standard line is, I am paid to not have an opinion. However, what I will say, and I think my editors will support me on this, I believe that it is issues like this where journalism is so important. Because I can tell you, I think about the conversations that I have had with families. I see familiar faces here in the crowd today, and it is impossible to look at any of them and not see their loved one and not see their one struggling. And it is a gift that I get to hear that story, but it is an even bigger one to be able to share that with people. And I think our world is a better place because of good journalism and because of us, you know, having a better understanding. So.
Thank you. Amen.
But thank you for your compliment.
Hi. I know that a lot of your research seems to be focused on the geographical point of view, but it also has a lot of individualistic information thrown in. Does your project also focus on data about opiate orphans?
No. Okay. Not this particular project. No, it doesn't. There may be an opportunity down the road, but that isn't something we've addressed. And by the way, we have a lot of research projects at the Center for Drug and Health Studies, and the director, Dr. Christy Vischer, is here in the audience with us today, and some of my other colleagues from CDAS. So we can act as a bit of a warehouse for information and point you in the right direction if you want to stop by our offices. But it's not a population that is currently part of my research projects.
Thank you. The receptors that, or the triggers that trigger this genetic signal for the receptors to hook onto those opioids, they have been there. I don't think that we have changed genetically so much in the few last, say, 50 years or so. What has changed is the availability of these opioids. Mm-hmm. So if there is the problem, if there is the issue, I didn't hear either of you talk about the producer of these drugs. I know there is some legislation that is in process about reducing the total product, but there are six major producers of these famous drugs, and if you look at their profile, the largest money-earning drugs are these opioids in their profile. So there is a place that effort can be put to reduce some of these problems.
So Delaware actually has a lawsuit against Big Pharma. I was actually in court arguments last week. Big Pharma had, I can tell you, 25 attorneys in a courtroom. I'm telling you, I was in a pink coat and I stuck out like a sore thumb compared to all the black and the gray and the blue. I will tell you, they are fighting to have the lawsuit dismissed in Delaware court. Matt Den, many of you know our state attorney general, has made very, very big strides in the opioid epidemic, took it on in a way that many attorney generals have not in the past, but are now in terms of legal matters. And they launched this, they launched a very, very big lawsuit against Big Pharma. They were able to keep it in Delaware court despite efforts to get it to federal court. But they are arguing for dismissal of the lawsuit. And we're talking on arguments of show us exact prescriptions that were illegally diverted. And mind you, these are companies that have already paid out millions of dollars in settlements with individuals, with organizations. Part of the reason we're seeing this pushback now is because we are seeing counties go after them, we're seeing cities go after them, we're seeing full states in efforts to recoup some of that money that has been lost. And so you are incredibly correct. There's also the argument that a lot of companies now making medication-assisted treatment, that the same companies who created the epidemic are now making the medications that are going to be used to treat the epidemic.
Create the problem.
That is a great question, a great argument, and I would encourage you to definitely stay up to date on it. We're going to keep covering it. It's really interesting. It's really important. But there is a judge out in Ohio that is handling a lot of the federal cases, and he basically has come out and said, like, consolidate them, figure out your settlements, and, like, let's deal with this because this is ridiculous. Like, this keeps happening. Let's go. Like, let's move it along.
The amount of money they have enables them to push back on a lot of the solutions that could be forthcoming. I mean, just their influence on the DEA and their relaxing of the standards in when suspicious shipments from a distributor would come on the radar screen of DEA and therefore warrant an investigation. You know, retired DEA agents and you know, going to work for Big Pharma, or just the pressure that they put on the lobbying aspect. We have a formidable foe, you know, in this problem. And, you know, that whole industry side of it, definitely, we wait till the problem hits people, and then we offer solutions, you know. But that's another way to solve the problem, you know, is to tighten up, you know, the manufacture and distribution of those drugs. We just have to be willing to do it.
So a bit on the opposite end of that, I enjoy thinking kind of radically, and. Don't get the opportunity to discuss with an actual expert on something like this, and I haven't been able to find much research on something like this, maybe because it is ridiculous. But do you have any research or just your own opinions on legalizing drugs like these so that you know, they're put in a place where it can be more controlled and people aren't put in positions where they might take a drug that is, you know, potentially life-threatening? Or a dose that could otherwise be prevented if it wasn't illegal, or they might seek help if it wasn't illegal.
Which drugs are you talking about, if I may ask you to clarify?
Something like heroin. I mean, and I know that sounds crazy, but a prohibition, you know, when alcohol was illegal, there were more problems because of it. Mm-hmm. So do you have a gut reaction to that? I mean, I know it sounds crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I personally, and I don't speak on behalf of my department or my center, all these disqualifiers, right, or my funders, I would not support legalization of heroin. I definitely would not do that. Not with what I have seen. And remember, legal drugs started this problem, right? Legal drugs started this problem. I'm not sure that legalization, I hear where you're coming from. And I would say this to you. If we were waging a war on drugs and we were responding with criminalization with the full forces we did in the 80s, I think your argument carries more weight. But we're turning that page right now. And people who are suffering from opioid misuse disorder, we're not criminalizing them like we did in the past. And so with a more humane approach, a more public health approach, isn't that sort of what you're talking about anyway? Food for thought.
In response to the question about where the drugs are coming from, the pharmaceutical companies, none of them are going to release a nickel bag of heroin. The reason that heroin is so cheap is because every year since the fall of 2001, when we invaded Afghanistan, and just in time for the spring planting and the summer harvest, every year since then has been a record opium poppy crop. Donald Rumsfeld sits on the board of at least one pharmaceutical company, and The opium that makes the heroin comes from fields guarded by U.S. soldiers and supervised by the CIA. And they have a long history of bringing heroin into this country. You can Google Pan Am 103 and heroin, and you will see all sorts of sites come up from that.
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree with that. Here's where I'm going to disagree. I think I would have agreed with you for the prior heroin epidemics of the 60s and 70s, when most U.S. heroin did come from what we call that Golden Triangle. And I'm not saying there isn't a lot of heroin produced in the Golden Triangle, but today in the United States, most of the heroin comes from Mexico and Colombia. It doesn't come from Afghanistan. Mexico and Colombia. It's distributed in Europe and in Asia, and addiction there is to Afghani heroin. Some of that is also goes into the manufacturing of semi-synthetic opioid painkillers that are distributed in the market. But in terms of the heroin, U.S. heroin today comes mostly from Mexico and Colombia. Mm-hmm. Right. And it is true that the sale of heroin helped supply Osama bin Laden. That is true, and that's well documented. But my point of departure from you is where most heroin in the United States come from today.
I know that a lot of your research focuses on the big opioid overdoses and whatnot. There have been a lot of things going around about a strain of opioids and a strain of heroin that's been going around certain music scenes, especially around here, that are not able to be helped through with the use of Narcan. Mm. Is there any kind of information that you have on that, or maybe about, I don't know, making Narcan more accessible to general people? Because as far as I know, I can't get it. I can't be able to purchase Narcan or use Narcan unless I go through training. And right. That's not going to help me with my friend who's overdosing right. in the bathroom.
Well, I hung up my dancing shoes a little while ago when I finished the rave culture book. So I'm not out there in the music scene anymore. But I do know that there are some types. While I might not have heard about what you're talking about specifically, I do know that there are some kinds of opioids people take. It takes more than one dose of Narcan to revive people. Sometimes it takes two doses. I don't know if I've ever heard of a third dose.
Sometimes, so the good news is Delaware has passed laws that you can go into a pharmacy. You watch it's like genuinely 3 to 5 minutes. You watch a 3 to 5 minute training video, and they will give you naloxone, and you can take it with you. There is also a lot of efforts, and I see Dave Humes giving me the finger back there in a good way. There are a lot of community groups, though, that are now also going out and distributing it for free. I do know, too, that, and maybe this is what Dave's going to say, there is going to be a training class coming up too, but you can now go into most any police departments. You can reach out to community organizations. You can go to a pharmacy, and you can get it. And it does not take a long time. Because there are hugely more efforts now being made to get it out into the hands of the average person. Yeah, great question.
Just a couple comments on marketing. You can go and get it over the counter at a pharmacy. You go to helpishere.de.com website. There's three different videos on there, depending on what kind of Narcan you want. And you watch those videos, you download a form saying that you understood the video and how to administer. You go to a pharmacy and you can purchase it. In addition, there's community trainings around the state that are had. And here on campus, there have been training to the student community. University of Delaware has purchased that Narcan for students. Hopefully there'll be an upcoming training within the next month or so.
I've been to the training. I was just talking about general accessibility to just people who wouldn't know about the videos or know about the
videos. Right. Thank you. And that's a good point. There's a lot of work that needs to be done for public education. Education and prevention is something we also haven't talked a lot about tonight. And her questions and comments remind me we need to increase our efforts on education and prevention, not just for the general public, but for doctors and prescribers, et cetera. Yes.
You asked before about the technical literature, and sorry to be a geek, but with the pharmacogenetics and personalized medicine, about 10% of the people, Narcan does not do any good. And so part of it is we're having to come up for some patients a very different approach.
Thank you.
Last question, maybe?
Sure.
No pressure. Sure. So I'm actually in a lecture at the University of Delaware where we have been talking quite a lot about this. So there is the prescription drug monitoring program, because a big problem that we're noticing is doctor shopping. So you go to wherever you can be prescribed these. So if I'm not mistaken, I don't think the state of Delaware actually actively is using the program correctly. Do you think that that's something that's going to be happening soon, or do you think that it's just one of those things we're going to push out of the way?
No, I know that recent legislation, and I'm not going to get the particulars perfectly correct, so don't quote me, but they recently just passed legislation that lifts some of the barriers around it in attempts to make it more accessible and easier to use for doctors, because there was a lot of pushback from some doctors that had said, we're having trouble using this, it's confusing, it's not necessarily doing what we need it to do. And so I know there is legislation that should be going into effect if it has not been signed into effect already, or at least it might have been signed but not really fully in effect yet, that's going to make it easier to use for doctors.
Yep.
Because that was a huge issue for Delaware for a long time.